Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a reading and conversation presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. Speaking will be author Anna Bicont and translator Alyssa Vallez. The subject of tonight's discussion is their new book titled The Crime and the Silence, Confronting the Massacre of Jews in Wartime Yadvabna. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Princeton University resident scholar and lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures, Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
I'm very happy to introduce a conversation between these two writers and to kind of talk about this very amazing, excellent book, The Crime and the Silence, which has been published right now by Farah Strauss Giroux. It's a translation of the Polish book written by Anna Bicont, and it is truly an unusual and excellent book, which combines first-person reporting and historical research, and is found a way of talking about the most horrific event in a way that is people are both able to read it and yet be very touched by it at the same time. The book is incredibly well translated by Alyssa Vallez, who is a poet and who is an author of a volume of poetry, and also she did an amazing thing, that is, she retranslated some of the poems that have not been translated of a great Polish poet, Zbigniew Herbert. So now there is a volume, all of his published work in English. And she was an absolutely ideal translator for Anna Bicont, who is an amazing writer and journalist, author of several books about kind of from the border of literature, culture, and politics. She is a co-author of a biography of Wisława Szymborska. She's also a co-author of a history of a book which is a history of the left-wing writers in Poland and their short love affair with communism. What I want to add also that she is an amazingly courageous person. She was one of the founding journalists of the underground publication Mazowsze Weekly, Mazovia Weekly, which was published by a group of journalists, especially all of them basically women, who managed to keep alive the name of Solidarity in the most dire times. She then was a co-founder of the Gazeta Wyborcza, the largest Polish newspaper, right around the time of 1989, when the elections happened that turned out to be free on the 4th of June of 1989. This is an introduction, a short, very short introduction of this for these two extraordinary women that are here. So I would like to start by asking and to give us a context, that is to tell us shortly about what this book is about, what is the event that we are talking about.
The Polish inhabitants of Jedwabne killed all but few Jewish neighbors. And Jedwabne, it's a small town in the near east of Poland. And before the war, half of the population were Catholics and half were Jews. It was not a shtetl, like we have this imagination of Jews living in shtetl, in life separated to the life of the others. No, in Jedwabne, the streets, the homes, the schools were shared by Poles and Jews. So they knew each other very well. They were neighbors, they were classmates, they were playmates. They really knew each other, and many Poles knew Yiddish also. And in the summer of 1941, in the 10th of July, all the Jewish inhabitants were rounded up in the marketplace, They were beaten, they were humiliated, the young women were raped. First, the young men and the old rabbi were killed with farmer tools, with axes. And then the whole population, so the elderly, the women, the children, the families in Jedwabne numbered often 6 or 8 children. All of them were held in the barn, and the barn was set on fire. So the Poles killed as much Jews as they could. They robbed as much as they could. They went to a mass. They drank vodka, and as if they forgot. In 2011, Jan Tomasz Gross's book Neighbors reminded them all of it. And the Jan Tomasz Gross book about the Jedwabne massacre provoked a huge debate in Poland, but really huge, the most important debate about our history that we had as a free country. And Jedwabne became the symbol of the crime committed in this part of Poland, but it was not only Jedwabne. 5 days before, in Wąsosz, it's a small village, all the inhabitants, all the Jewish inhabitants were killed one by one in one night with axes by Poles. 3 days before Jedwabne in Radziłów, all the inhabitants, Jewish inhabitants, were killed by Poles. Most of them were burned also in the barn. There were pogroms and riots in all this part of Poland. It was the time when, because Poland were divided between the Soviets and the German, when the war started, and it was this part of Poland who was under the Soviet occupation, and in June 1941, the Germans came to this part of Poland. And it was this time of interregime. And the Germans came, and they encouraged Poles to cleanse the towns of the Jews. So it's a short, yes, story, what happened.
Yeah, so if maybe I will not add to this rather horrific description. I wanted to ask Alisa, how was the process of translating? How did you feel about it?
And nightmarish.
Yeah.
Well, if you spend any length of time with this material, I think you start dreaming about it. But I think one of the things that drew me to the book, made me want to translate it, because I think I asked Anya if I could. I wasn't commissioned to do it. I wanted to do it as soon as I read it. One of the most interesting things about it, as a work of literature, I think, is the way it combines and contrasts sort of traditional historical narrative with a personal narrative. I mean, it's very rare that you come across, I mean, Holocaust literature is dominated by traditional historiography on the one hand, which has its own, you know, beauties and difficulties and pitfalls, and memoir on the other hand. And I think it's very rare and very risky for a writer to combine those two, because what happens as you read the book is not only do you follow Anya's research into what actually happened and the different distortions that occurred over time, but you follow her own process of her self-scrutiny and her awareness of the intimate temptation of prejudice, of describing things in a certain way that feels more comfortable to yourself and that protects you from painful painful awareness. And so she recognizes this and describes it in the town, in Yedvabna, and the surroundings, and all this sort of the psychological transformation that these people go through as the news breaks, as the other journalists start coming to the town and they become aware of their own story being world news. All the changes in the way people talk about what happened are colored by Anna's own investigation of language. And I think that from the point of view of, I'm a linguist, not a historian, from the point of view of a literary interest, it's unusual in that regard.
I asked you about your translation, but actually, before that, I should ask you, the author, what made you, why is it that you became, you started to investigate this story? Mm-hmm. Was this something obvious? What was so great about this story? Or what was so, mm-hmm. What attracted you to this? And to, how come it came, you just spent then 4 years, I understand, mm-hmm. working on it?
First, I wanted only to write a reportage because I was a journalist in Gazeta Wyborcza, and I thought that that it would be fascinating to tell the story what happened in a town that after 60 years, out of the blue, a book appeared and they were confronted with history and confronted in such a difficult manner because it was such a news in Poland that many journalists and many television set and from abroad, from Europe, many cameramen came, asked people on the street, what do you think about the murdering of a Jew? So it was obvious that we need a reportage about it in Gazeta. It was obvious. So I told Adam Michnik that I would come to Jedwabne, and he told me not to do, because Adam didn't want to publish fragments of Jan Gross' book and didn't want to write about it in Gazeta. And it was the first time that someone told me that I couldn't do something that I wanted to do, especially in my newspaper. It was my newspaper. And I was so shocked about it that I asked for a leave, 1 year leave, and I started to write a book. But when I started to write a book, I think that it would be a book, a supplement to Jan Gross's book, What Happened in the Village Now, that it would be a reportage. And when I came to the town, what was incredible, because there were a priest, Father Orłowski, who was a perfect organizer of hate. And all the people in Jedwabne hated the Jews that they were killed 60 years before. And it was like, so it was not about only about the present, but it was about the past. I could imagine what happened in the past, seeing now this priest and these people with so much hate. And it was such a shock for me that I started to investigate and to work on it. And it became my obsession for 4 years. Sorry, Olusia, my daughter, for these 4 years.
I want to ask you to continue what you were saying. That is, you said that there are basically traditionally two ways of writing about the Holocaust, which are historical inquiry and memoirs. But I could see that there are in the book and in your translation that you even translated some poetry for this book. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that there are other that you that the author wrote and that you were able mm-hmm. to somehow convey, and this other testimonies, other ways of reporting on this.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I don't know how conscious it was, this choice of the poems that are in this book. They come up naturally in the narrative, so it may not have been a preconceived structure at all, but there are basically three poems in this book, apart from the various anti-Semitic bits of doggerel that I labored to translate. There are three pieces of important poetry, and they, in a sense, they represent, well, two of them, one poem by Zbigniew Herbert, which was the one part of the book that I had already translated, Herbert's poem, which was written in the late 60s, which I think is also an interesting time in Poland to write a poem about the loss of the Jewish, nearly all Polish Jews. And at the end, or closer to the end, on the other side of the aesthetic spectrum, I would say, is a poem written in wartime by an extraordinarily gifted young Jewish woman who died shortly after. And the poem is actually about her her denouncer. And I think these two poems, I hope I have time to read them.
Yeah, maybe you could...
They're interesting because they both, in their own way, are a response to the Polish Romantic tradition, which is represented in this book by the third poem by Bialik. Bialik was referred to in Poland, I think, for a long time as the Hebrew Mickiewicz, that is the poet that a certain portion of Polish Jews looked to for expressions of nationalistic pride. And, you know, he wrote a famous poem, which I'm not going to read, because it's very long, called In the City of Slaughter, which is, in a sense, a poem that represents what both Herbert and Ginczanka, the young Jewish woman, who wrote a poem that's known as Non Omnis Moriar. Both of them are responding and, I think, rebelling against this particular way of talking about historical crimes and slaughter. So I just wanted to start by reading with a little bit of the surrounding text, Herbert's poem. This is a diary entry from July 9, 2001, which was the day before the commemoration of the massacre, which Gazeta Wyborcza featured on the front page with a photograph from Jedwabne, from pre-war Jedwabne. And on the same page was Herbert's poem. July 9, 2001. At the Gazeta, we're preparing tomorrow's issue on the 60th anniversary of the massacre. I brought photographs Meir Ronen gave me in Israel. I have to write captions for them, but it's hard to see who's who. In the end, I figure out that sometimes I have the people on a photograph written down from left to right, and other times from right to left. In Hebrew, you tell what's in a picture from right to left, just as you read. I call Ronen. Is he sure Shmuel Wasserstein is the little boy in the last row with the ears that stick out? And is it really Jakub Kubrzański and Moshe Olszewicz on either side of him, the two with whom he survived in hiding under the Wyszykowski's barn? Yes, it's them. I look at the mock-up of tomorrow's edition. In big print, a place that shrieks. A class picture from a Jedwabne grammar school. An editorial called Standing with the Truth. And Zbigniew Herbert's poem, Mr. Kogito Seeks Advice. Mr. Kogito Seeks Advice. So many books, dictionaries, bloated encyclopedias, but no one to give advice. They studied the sun, the moon, the stars. They lost me. My soul refuses the solace of knowledge. So I wander at night on our father's roads. And here is the town of Bratislava, amid black sunflowers. The place we abandoned, the place that shrieks. It's Shabbos. As always on Shabbos, a new heaven appears. I'm looking for you, Rebbe. He's not here, say the Hasidim. He is in the world of Sheol. He had a beautiful death, say the Hasidim. very beautiful, as if he crossed from one side to another side. He was all black, held in his hand a flaming Torah. "I'm looking for you, Rebbe. Beyond what firmament did you hide your wise ear? My heart aches, Rebbe. I have troubles. Rabbi Nachman might give me advice, but how do I find him among so many ashes?" I draw it to the managing editor's attention that he wanted a picture of Yedvabna's Jews, but he chose for the front page a class picture from 1936, by which time Polish children already formed the majority. But alongside the photo, he runs a handwritten note with the names of the pupils and teachers. The pupils were then 14 or 15. In 1941, they will have been 20. Three of the Polish boys have the same first and last names as later killers. But are they the same people? I'm inclined to think it's a good choice, a photograph that shows future victims, perpetrators, and witnesses of the massacre sitting side by side, smiling at the photographer.
It's you can see from this fragment, beautifully read, that in this book there is a combination of a personal voice of the research of the person who of the researcher of the kind of the chronicle of it, and also somehow insertion of providing of information about what is what was happening. Now, part of this information is information that you get from books, yes, or but. Here, the information is from people. So you were talking to somebody in Israel, yes? The, mm-hmm. Or the person who provided you with the photograph. Who were your sources, and how did you manage to speak to them? We'll go, come back to the second poem later on.
Yes, I talked with Jews who survived the massacre. Shmuel Wasserstein, the one whose testimony were the main reason that Jan Gross wrote his book, was not still alive, but I went to Costa Rica to talk with the family. I talked with Avigdor Kochav, who survived. But also I knew a lot because I talked with all possible Poles who was at the time in Jedwabne. And so I came to Jedwabne many, many times after the dark, because people were afraid to talk with me if someone saw that I want to talk with them. And I knocked to the doors. I think that I knocked to maybe 200 doors in Jedwabne, and many, many times, so the people just shut the door at my face. But sometime I succeeded to talk with them. It was a quite difficult task because I did a lot of interview in Gazeta, and I think about myself that I am a good interviewer. And in Jedwabne, I need to do an interview, but not asking questions. It's not very simple because people were extremely scared with questions. So I came with because after the war, there were in Poland many trials of Poles killing the Jews. And there were a huge trial in Jedwabne where 22 men were accused of killing Jews, and many of them were sentenced. And I had these court trials. So I knocked the door, I came, and I told, you know, I have a trial, maybe you want to know something, the trial files, maybe you want to know something about your neighbors. And of course, everyone wants to know something about the neighbors. So they started to talk with me, and it was like this Gross book, you know. Gross is a Jew, and it's all lie that the Jews, the Poles killed the Jews. But what is the name? Świętkowski? Oh, yes, this one. Yes, this one. He raped the Jewish woman before killing them. He raped his own daughter. So why he didn't want to rape Jewish woman? And so I had a lot of pieces of materials. More than from Jews who were in hiding if they survived, so they didn't saw all these things that Poles saw. But what was more difficult, it was not to talk with people who didn't want to talk with me, because finally I arrived to talk with them. The most difficult for me was talking with people who wanted to talk with me. There were three or four women in Jedwabne who waited for me 60 years, because they wanted to tell the truth. And I met with them many times. And one of them, because she told to me she was beaten by her family. The other one, after talking with me, the priest came to her to tell her that she would not be buried in the Catholic cemetery. So I talked with them. I came back to Warsaw, and they stayed. And it was very hard to do it. Also.
It seems to me one of the most moving stories in the there are many. It's just an extraordinary repository of stories, this book. But one of the most confusing to me and also moving biographies is the Mariana Ramatowska, who fell in love with a Pole, married him, you know, was baptized, married him, and was saved that way. And this is an extraordinary, haunting figure, because she still lives in Jedwabne after all these years. Her entire family was wiped out. She doesn't want to leave. And she feels guilty towards the people around her. I mean, it's an extraordinary inversion of guilt. She feels she has to pay her in-laws to be accepted in the family, even so many decades after being, you know, part of the family, and essentially giving up her entire heritage. And I wonder whether you did you. It seems to me she is a woman who's so closed that almost, of course, they don't want to talk to you. The Ramatowskis don't want to talk to you in the beginning, but you manage to get them talking, and then you become quite close to them. But I have the feeling that you never really got to the heart of Mariana, or no. Rachela, as she was before the war. There was something in her that just could not be unlocked. And
yes, she interiorized this hate of Poles against Jews, and she was ashamed that she was a Jew. She was very Catholic, and her husband, who saved her life, he was very open, and he liked me, and he wanted always to tell me new stories about what happened, and she not, never. And when they, because the last years of their life, they were near Warsaw, I took care of them. And I asked the woman who took care of her to ask Mariana something about her childhood. And she never wanted, you know, to the person that she was 24 hours, because Stanisław Ramotowski died before her. Mm-hmm. She never told one word about her childhood. It was completely, completely closed. And she was so scared, because in Jedwabne, really, a lot of people were sentenced for killing the Jews. And in Radziu, almost, because she was on the nearby from the nearby town where the Jews were burned alive. And from Radziwów, almost no one were sentenced because Marianna Ramotowska witnesses for them that they were good people and they helped a lot, Jews a lot. And
there's even a story that she sees the possessions of her parents in the houses of her neighbors. There's one case where she wanted, I think, she offered to buy one of the pieces of furniture mm-hmm. back that had been looted from her parents' home.
Yes, and she mm-hmm. and she had she received a death sentence on her door after, mm-hmm. and she repeated to me so many times, but I wanted to have this backboard again. I wanted to pay for it. It was not for free that I wanted mm-hmm. because it's mine. I only wanted to pay and pay three more that it was this value of this cupboard. Mm-hmm. No, it was pathetic.
But it seems to me also very important that you deal with the distortions of survivors. I mean, the ways that trauma distorts the memories of those who survived, or in some cases, those who left Yedvabna and the area just before the war, but have all kinds of inherited stories about it. So what it's also part of the problem of what happens in emigration, it seems to me, that certain memories become sentimentalized and, mm-hmm. you know, people clutch onto them because they're necessary. And they have, at a certain point, very little to do with what mm-hmm. really happened. It seems very important to the balance of the book that you deal with, you know, the Jewish distortions as well as the Polish distortions.
Yes, it was, for me, it was very, I haven't accepted it because I am a psychologist and a psychotherapist by education and by education, and I was sure that, it was good for people to talk, you know, that it's the need of each people to talk about especially about the traumas, but now I think that it's not like this. It's too more complicated than I thought. And for many people, it was so difficult to talk with me because all this, it came again to their mind. Mm-hmm. And each of the survivors had his own way to escape from this memory. Avigdor Kochasz, for example, the main witness, he talked always the same story. He repeated for 3 hours the same story. And it was very difficult to ask him something because he was completely disturbed. And Shmuel Wasserstein, he reinvented all the story. It was reinvented all the story. Mm-hmm. It had something to do with the reality, but it was most a story from the Old Testament with terrifying scenes. Mm. And they wanted to be part of their story, or the Rabbi Baker, who had a story that that the old rabbi was killed with all the population, and all the population recited a poem, and with these holy words, they were burned. And it was not true at all because the old rabbi were killed before. And, you know, for Abby Baker, I thought that he would, you know, it was not possible for him to imagine another version mm-hmm. of his truth about it.
I would like, apropos of this cupboard of Marianna Ramotowska, I would like to ask you before we open the floor for questions, because this is we have very short time for such a topic. I just wanted to ask you to read this poem of Zuzanna Ginczanka, because this is a poem that, first of all, has been written from within the Holocaust. Yes, this was a poem that was written right after she was denounced and she escaped. She managed to save herself. And then the next time, she did not survive. She did not manage to save herself. And the poem also has this history that mm-hmm. he said. So please maybe say a few words if you want and to read it for us. And
Well, it's important to know about this poem that it's there's a very famous romantic poem called Testament Mój, My Testament, by the romantic poet Juliusz Słowacki. And on a very in a very direct lexical way, this poem responds to that and parodies it. I'm going to read it with a little bit of text that comes before it in the book. Anna writes about the memoir. She's reading a memoir. One of the most valuable sources of information is the memoir of a woman named Chaya Finkelstein, who was from a wealthier family and managed to shepherd her family through many dangers. The theme of stolen things returns again and again in the memoir. We read of women rushing to plunder her house, this is Chaya Finkelstein's house, while the men escort the Jews to the barn. Chaya describes being in hiding and looking through gaps in the sheathing of a barn on Sundays at farmers' children going to church dressed in clothes stolen from her own children. Moving from one household to another, everywhere they found Jewish clothing or furniture, because even those who didn't pillage were given such things in payment for butter or honey. What Chaya describes in her memoir, I already read once in the form of a poem by Sarah Ginsburg, known by her pen name, Zuzanna Ginczanka. Non omnis moriar. My proud possessions, tablecloth meadows, staunch fortress shelves, my billowing sheets and precious bedclothes, my dresses, my bright dresses will outlive me. I leave no heirs behind when I depart, so may your hand dig out all Jewish things, Chominova of Lvov, brave snitch's wife, prompt informer, Volksdeutscher's mother. May they serve you and yours, for why should they serve strangers? My neighbors, what I leave is neither loot nor empty name. I remember you as you, the Shuponir, remembered me, reminded them of me. May my friends sit and raise their glasses, drink to my grave and to their own gains. Carpets and tapestries, china, candlesticks. May they drink all night and at dawn start the search for gems and gold under sofas, mattresses, quilts, and rugs. Oh, how the work will burn in their hands, the tangles of horsehair and tufts of wool, blizzards of burst pillows, clouds of eiderdown, stick to their hands and turn them into wings. My blood will glue oakum and fresh feathers, transforming birds of prey into sudden angels. Ginczanka was in hiding on the Aryan side, first in Lvov, then in Kraków. She wasn't as lucky as the Finkelsteins. Someone denounced her. We don't even know when and in what circumstances she died, and by what miracle the sheet of paper survived with the prophetic poem, an adaptation of Słowacki's famous testament, which she wrote just before her death.
Thank you. So I think maybe we should, I'm sure you will have a lot of questions and to both of both Anna Bikont and Elisa Wales. This is an incredibly complicated story, and we just touched it truly on the surface only.
You mentioned about out of the whole town that there were maybe four people who wanted to tell the truth. Why do you think those people specifically, why did that desire to speak come about in those people, do you think?
there were people who first who didn't participate to the, you know, to the looting of things or to, you know, help help the Poles. The other did what they did because it was. This day was like a picnic, you know, that all the people, you know, the youngest came, the 12 years old children came to the barn with 7-year-old, and the 7-year-old came with the 3-year-old. So it was really the whole population who took part. And this was this one who cried this day because there was there. You know, the best friends who were a Jewish girl so they had special ties. All these old women were from the left, you know, it was, so they were not under this influence of a priest. Of course, they wanted to be buried in the Catholic cemetery, we have no other cemeteries, but they were not very Catholic people, the one they wanted to talk with me. But for the next generation, it was not the same. For the next generation, the people who wanted to talk with me, sometimes they were children of someone who killed the Jews, and they wanted to know what their fathers did.
Yeah, this was really fascinating, also very painful. I'm very interested in these issues of changing memories over time. And what it seems to me that you're suggesting here, and I'll need to read the book, of course, is that they keep the same memory of the events over time, that the old people you talk to, it's as if there's no development. Is that because there was total silence during these years? And is this priest the same priest who was there at the time or who just keeps the memory? Mm-hmm. So that's question number mm-hmm. one. And then just a little comment in response to your mm-hmm. statement about survivors and mm-hmm. and the woman who couldn't actually even talk about the childhood. I've recently read an article in psychiatry about the kind of trauma, and that whereas psychiatrists used to say, this is what you need to do, you need to, for instance, in particular, think that you need to relive the trauma in order to get beyond it, now it may very well be that that's the last thing you want to do. Mm-hmm. If it's so deeply embedded mm-hmm. that, in fact, you're destroyed. And apparently mm-hmm. many people commit suicide when they uncover these terrible memories. And it seems to me that one mm-hmm. Jewish woman, you know, had recreated her life a certain way and therefore couldn't possibly go into those memories because then mm-hmm. it destroys mm-hmm. hers, who she is, or she became.
Yes. Yes, you are right. About the priest, no. The priest was maybe 50 years old, and he was not about Yedva. He was not from Yedvabne, so he didn't know nothing about what happened. Really nothing. So he reinvented the story, and it was. I was in two meetings like this. He organized meetings in the church, and people were sitting like you are. And for old people, so the old people who were in Yedvabne in this time and saw what happened. And he told to them that 363 Germans came to Yedvabne this day. One by motorcycles, one by planes, and one division by, I don't remember, by tanks. But it was a very detailed, you know, story about what happened. In these old people who were in this time at Vapne, they learned this history. And after, when we talked with people from Vapne, they told you, and not only me, but also to the prosecutor, to the official prosecutor, because it was also an investigation from the Institute of National Remembrance in Poland. They told to the prosecutor that they saw 363 Germans. And it was because I think that the story, of course, it was not a silence in the sense that when people became drunk, they told the story that someone raped someone or someone took, you know, because it's also the problem of a Jewish cult, you know, it's an obsession in my country. And so it was always that they had a Jewish cult, but I didn't have anything about all this mess, you know, but it was not, it was always, but my house is my house, you know. So it means that the other house is a Jewish house. So I think that it was always in the conversation, but some fragments of the story, that no one told the continuity, some what happened, but some small stories, small talks about, you know, what happened. It was what arrived, and the priest told a new version, and it was the Jedwabne official version of the town.
And how do we know that this is not an official, that this is not a true version?
When we talked with people before the priest invented all this story, they told us about, for example, three Germans. And I talked with the first witness in my book, with Adam Michnik, and we asked them how many. He told also that it was a lie, that Poles did it, the Germans did it. So we asked how many Germans they were, and he told us three Germans. So it was after the priest told the story that the Germans arrived in the town. And the prosecutor also, he asked very detailed questions. So when we were in this time when we saw these Germans, and all these witnesses were disqualified by him. Mm-hmm. Yes,
because there was an inquiry, official inquiry by mm-hmm. the Institute of National Memory, which lasted for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. Yes. And which collected a lot of documentation and published 2 volumes of this documentation. And the final conclusion of the prosecutors was that it was that they inspired and permitted it.
Yes.
Yeah, but the execution of they kind of put it in motion, but the execution was actually local.
Mm-hmm.
So that is this was a very long process and very complicated. It included the exhumation. It included a lot of work, but this was published as an official documentation.
Just one thing I wanted to add is that along with, although this is not a very funny book, there are several very funny strains running through it, and one of them has to do with the creation in Jedwabne of the Committee to Defend the Good Name of Jedwabne, which I think is like a Gogolian story of people getting together determined to defend the good name of a town in the face of absolutely all the evidence. And the people who are drawn to this committee and the way they, you know, in a sense you see they're trying to consolidate their version, whereas they seem to have realized fairly early on in all the public upheaval that they needed to get their story straight about mm-hmm. the good Jedwabne. And so this committee is almost like a committee to rewrite history.
Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious. I mean, it's all, of course, disgusting, but it's also very funny. And it's one of the many sort of novelistic strains in the novel, in the book, sorry, which I think Julian Barnes picks up on in his review. You know, there are many stories. One of the strengths of the book is that it contains extraordinary descriptions of character and the little plots that go on in this small town.
And yes, in Jedwabne is completely clear that the that the memory is a battle and who won this battle in Jedwabne. Because it's not in my book because it came after that in the marketplace, so it's the very place that the Jews were in the very hot summer day, they stand all the day. They built the inhabitants of today Jedwabne built a counter monument. And it's a monument dedicated to Poles who were killed by Soviets, who were deported by Soviets to the camps. And they wanted an inscription that it's a monument dedicated to Poles who were killed by the Soviets because they were denounced to the Soviet secret police by Jews. And it was not, it's not, you know, you, it's not possible to write whatever you want in the official inscription, but what they thought about this monument and what they teach in the school about it, that it's the monument of the Poles denounced by Jews. So it's really Freud had something to do with it, yes.
So I'm interrupting this conversation at that moment. I mean, it is basically barely opening because it's so many. It's such a rich subject. I thank you very much, and I thank you very much, and I thank you very much, and goodbye. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation with author Anna Bekont and translator Alyssa Velez on their new book titled The Crime and the Silence, Confronting the Massacre of Jews in Wartime Jedwabne. Tonight's event was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe and the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. Tonight's moderator was Princeton University resident scholar and lecturer in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures, Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jeff Turton. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.